Greetings, crew, members of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, and whoever else who cares to listen. This is part two of my recording of the initial conditions of the divine experiment conceived by the Aeon Sophia in the galactic core previous to the appearance of our world, of our planet, which she herself became. This is February 23rd, 2012, and the timing of this intel is extremely critical. Those of you who are involved in the experiment need to know this information, if I may use that cheap word, right now. You need to know these missing chapters of the Sophianic vision story right now. And you need to ground them, integrate them, remember them, repeat them, take them into your life, and guard them as if they were as precious to you as your own life story. Because without her story and her life, ours is nothing, and we have no life. Others may listen to this recording later on, 6 months or a year or 6 years from now, and you yourselves may listen to it at some later time. And those who do will find at that time, I believe, that the information as such, the narrative content as such, will be just as important then as it is now. It can be integrated then as now. But we now, in the spring of 2012, stand in a unique position. We have a unique opportunity not only to retrieve these missing elements of the Sophianic vision story, but also to participate in how Sophia makes her correction in real time based on this retrieval, based on her own retrieval in divine memory, based on her own sorcery act of recapitulation. So immediate to her recall, she performs the correction corresponding to that recall. That is why it is such a fantastic opportunity to live through this process with her in real time. Now, in the crew notes, number 16, that accompany these two recordings, I present an outline of the concepts that are required to retain this narrative sequence. I'm telling a story. It's a narrative sequence. But in order to retain the narrative, you need to be sure that you have a clear and cogent grasp of the particular concepts that come up in the narrative. And so I'm not going to give a full written exposition of these missing episodes in written form right now. I'm not going to do it in the crew notes or anywhere else because time does not permit that right now. Oral transmission is the best way to offer and present these missing episodes of the Sophianic vision story. But I do provide in the crew notes an outline of the concepts. So let's just review quickly how the Aeon Sophia and Thilete calibrated our endowment, how they designed and engineered our capacities to live and act as the creatures we are. Anthropos 10, the 10th strain of the Anthropos template embedded in the Orion Nebula. There are basically 7 components in the calibration, starting with 1, which is the substrate of all calibrations of sentient life, nous, the gift of divine intelligence, which emerges in the material reality as nucleic acid. Two, dianoia, our capacity for communication and signal systems, codes, signals. Three, metanoia, our capacity to form paradigms and to understand systems and then go beyond that framework into other systems and other systems to continually outgrow our own understanding of systems so that we don't become locked in any single system or paradigm. Four, perinoia, the ludic capacity to play and pretend. I have a lot more to say about this because it figures very critically in Sophia's own understanding of the ultimate threat to our experiment on this planet. Five, enthymesis, which means that which is in the thymus. It means the enthusiasm and passion of embodiment, the erotic capacity. Then the two signatures of the designing aeons. Free will, the signature of thelete, which gives us our latitude, which is a dangerous latitude. You give an animal that much rope and there's a risk it's going to hang itself. And wisdom, the cognitive capacity for ever higher learning that comes from the wisdom goddess herself. You'll notice that I don't include the luminous epinoia in here because the luminous epinoia was not given in the original calibration of our genomic identity. No, it was added later, as the story clearly shows, when Sophia realized that humanity would face the menace of the Archons. She added an extra component to our makeup. That component is the divine epinoia. It's extremely important in this practice to have a clear knowledge of what these seven or eight elements are and to be able to repeat them out of your own self. I would add that one more thing before returning to the plot here. I've pointed out that each of these components of our endowment is to be understood in three ways. First, it is a divine or archetypal capacity gifted to us from the aeons or the generators who themselves receive their potentialities from the originator. Capacity. It is also a capacity, a particular capacity, an ability to behave or act in a certain way. So it is an archetypal gift. It is a capacity. And finally, it is an actual chemical component. And these chemical components are called reciprocates. So the reciprocate, for instance, I've discussed the reciprocates of the five components that were specified in our calibration. And I was given the clear perception of these reciprocates at the very moment that I tracked her memory in real time. I didn't cook them up or think them up or abstractly work them out. They appeared as spontaneously self-evident at the moment that her memory retrieved what she had done. So there are, you might wonder, are there specific chemical, neurochemical, and physiological reciprocates to the signature components of Thelete and Sophia? Well, certainly there are. I will just mention what they are to complete the picture, and I will list them here in the outline of concepts in crew note 6, but I won't elaborate on them at this point because it would take too long. Actually, these two reciprocates of the signature doses, the super doses, we must begin to understand now, given to our G genomic identity are really, really fascinating and explain a great deal about our behavior, our immediate social behavior, and the problems in our behavior. Strangely, bizarrely perhaps, the signature dose of stilete, which is free will or cognitive latitude, enough rope to hang yourself, is closely related to the emotion of fear and to the chemical correlate of fear, which is adrenocortisone. So the chemical adrenocortisone is present in your body so that in a condition of fear, your body will react chemically, and that chemical will send a message to the brain that you should watch out what you're doing. Now, why is this chemical adrenocortisone, which is dangerously over-excessive in psychopaths, in fact, they're addicted to adrenocortisone, why is this chemical and its corresponding emotion, fear, related to the sublime contribution of the aeon telete? Well, very simply because it has to be that way, because if a creature, a sentient creature, is given enormous latitude to take chances, then it needs fear in order to tell it when it is at the borderline of the chances it should take. Now, if I'm walking along a mountain path that's rather narrow going down into the Grand Canyon, my fear tells me when I might be losing my foothold. My fear tells me when I'm pushing the boundary a little bit too far and using a little bit too much of that cognitive latitude. I'm free to do anything I want to do as I'm walking down a narrow track in the Grand Canyon. I can do the jitterbug if I want to. I can dance around like a maniac. But if I start dancing around and doing the jitterbug, there's a great risk that I may exceed the boundaries of safety and fall off the path. How would I know that? Because adrenocortisone would kick in. My body itself would tell me that I am exceeding the limit of my cognitive latitude, and I would draw back. On the other hand, what is the chemical? And this would be quite a revelation, I suppose, if we could understand this. What is the chemical connected with the excessive learning abilities and proprioception granted to us by the Aeon Sophia? Well, quite simply, something called serotonin. But serotonin also has a real drawback. You see, fear has a drawback because we as creatures can become addicted to the thrill of fear. And that's not what that chemical is meant to do for us. Likewise, there's some problems with serotonin regarding the endowment to learn at a level of genius, which comes to us from the Divine Sophia. Basically, there is a extremely delicate balance of serotonin uptake in the brain, and there is always, the serotonin uptake circuits are always like operating like a toggle switch that very delicately toggles out of balance one way or the other. If there is too little of the serotonin uptake, we easily become dull and obtuse. And that's one of the great, great dangers of our species, as we can see. How can we be dumbed down? Well, we can be dumbed down because we have a disposition to dumb down. And that is due to a weakening of the serotonin uptake. On the other hand, if there is just a little too much of the serotonin uptake, then we can become gullible or complacent and compliant, which is also a problem that stunts our learning abilities. So you can see that the chemical reciprocate of serotonin, that is the correlate of our wisdom endowment, operates on a very, very delicate margin. A very delicate margin. Something that we need to understand in ourselves, something that we can perceive in our social behavior and in our collective behavior. And I think the symptoms of that precarious situation are pretty obvious lately. Now, finally, before turning to the plot, I ought to mention the luminous epinoia, which is the power of imagination. Recall that we were not initially dosed with the power of imagination in the calibration of our genomic identity that occurred previous to Sophia's plunge, previous to her separation. She added that, and this is an event to look at very closely, coming up in her recapitulation as well, the moment when she added that, the reasoning, as it were, in her divine intelligence that compelled her to add the luminous epinoia, as described in the mythical narrative in episode 5. So just to complete this outline of the 8 factors in our endowment, the chemical reciprocate to epinoia is what is known as mitogenic radiation. And mitogenic radiation, which is the actual radiation of light from the ribosomes in the human body and is closely connected with the emission of light by DNA itself, was discovered by the Russian scientist Gervitz in the 1920s. Very interesting that the Russians were the first to discover divine epinoia in its neurochemical and neurophysical aspect. So, with all of that intel defined, let's return to the main plot here. We're still separating those parchment pages of episode 4 that were stuck together. We've already read a couple of those pages. Let's say we've read 2. And now we come to the 3rd page of episode 4, which has not previously been accessible. And on this page, we read the account of how the Aeon Sophia, a young Aeon, only 14 years old, a young gifted prodigy among the Aeons, considered completely on her own how she would rectify the situation that produced the catastrophic outcome in the 9 previous planetary settings. Sophia looked very, very closely at the calibration of the Anthropos genome, as I've said. She knew that the calibrations could not be changed now that the genome had been implanted in the 3rd galactic arm, and, as it were, she had to follow standard procedure. This is how it's done. The Aeons as a whole had assisted her in Thelete to embed that template in the Orion Nebula. But consistent with the respect that the Aeons have for the freedom of these experiments, and also consistent with their desire to see something happen that they cannot predict or anticipate, these experiments are left to unfold on their own terms. Well, not exactly. Sort of. You see, it's choice. The Aeons have a choice if they wish to let a planetary experiment with a sentient plasm unfold on its own terms or not. Basically, they have two choices. One choice is that they can perform an intervention scenario. That is to say, suppose one of the elder aeons or a couple of the elder aeons had conceived some kind of pentagrammic or five-pointed sentient creature, which is the standard model through many galaxies. The humanoid form is a pentagrammic creature with a head and four limbs. And suppose a couple of elder aeons had conceived such an experiment. They engineered the genomic identity, the phenome, for that particular strain, and they projected it into the galactic limbs, and then they watched it unfold in a number of experiments, and they have the option that if they see one of those experiments going wrong, they can actually intervene in an avataric scenario. So that's one option they have. And sometimes they do that. Sometimes they just let it go the way it goes. Sometimes they present themselves within the scenario of that planetary world. And there are many instances of this and many stories floating around. The most well-known, of course, being the 10 avatars of Vishnu. As a matter of fact, and you have to fasten your seatbelts on this one, at least I did, I was pretty much staggered for about an hour over this as I sat downstairs in front of the blazing fire in my living room in the middle of January with my jaw dragging on the floor. I'll give it to you as it came to me. I guess I would have to say, to be honest, that you have to be in love with telestic practice. You have to be totally hooked. You have to realize what a fantastic privilege it is to do this practice and how voracious and truly scientific it is, while at the same time it reaches the heights of poetic imagination. You have to really enjoy it in order to be able to get to a moment where it gives you the jackpot. When we look at the inventory of world mythology, we find very unique and outstanding clues to Sophianic cosmology in certain Asian evidence. Primarily, that evidence is centered on the figure of Vishnu, the dreaming god. Through the understanding of the metaphysics, if you want to call it that, of Vishnu, we're able to learn a very important lesson about how the Pleromic aeons operate. The Hindu myth that says that Vishnu dreams the world is technically called an oneric myth, from the Greek word oneros, meaning dream. So we understand that the world is dreamed by the Pleromic aeons, and we learn this from the Hindu myth of Vishnu, the cosmic dreamer. Tremendous background, tremendous support for the Sophianic vision story. But at the same time, it even gets better, because Hindu tradition preserves the story of 9 events in which Vishnu, the cosmic dreamer, actually intervened in his own dream scenarios. Hence, if we look at the record of Hindu mythology, we have the evidence of 9 intervention scenarios. Recall that an intervention scenario is an option of the pleromic eons. They don't have to take it. They don't have to not take it. But if they choose to do so, if they so intend through divine anoia, they can project themselves into any planetary experiment they have set in motion by the process of imaginative projection from the galactic core. And if we are to respect and observe the evidence of Hindu myth, there is some kind of record that this happened 9 times. Well, what are those 9 avatars of Vishnu? The fish avatar, the boar avatar, and so forth. What are those 9 avatars of Vishnu? They are like fossilized remains in the human imagination of events that Sophia herself performed in her own imagination. Recall that she and the other aeons witnessed 9 failed experiments with the anthropic strain previous to our world. When Sophia was reviewing the calibration of our genome or phenome, when she was going through that process in the Pleroma, which she has recently recalled in January of 2012, in real time, she also recalled the elaborate exercise she undertook to come to terms with the problem. She undertook a very, very deeply elaborate exercise in the Pleroma. She held herself responsible for all those 9 previous experiments that went wrong due to the anthropos strain, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, turning against its environment. And she constructed imaginatively a rescue scenario for each one of those. That is to say, she looked at Anthropos 1, which was a strain of humans just like us that appeared in some planetary world in the third galactic arm long before we appeared, or the Earth appeared. She looked at that one, and 2 and 3. She looked at the particular conditions that went wrong in each of those experiments, and she constructed how she would have intervened in each of those 9 previous scenarios. And those are what humans remember in the mythological record of our imagination, in the mythological annals of the human psyche. We remember those hypothetical events as the 9 avatars of Vishnu. But they're not just 9. There are 10. And the great mystics of Asia and of the Himalaya and of the subcontinent of India, in their yogic capacities of recall, were also able to see that additional to the 9 interventions which the divine Sophia imagined, there was a 10th one called Kalki, the intervention of the future, but now, no longer future, the intervention of now. And so the Kalki avatar, or the 10th incarnation of Vishnu, is actually a prefiguration of Gaia's pleromic dreaming of how she would intervene. Now, in this second part of my account of the initial conditions, I'm not going to describe that intervention scenario. Not quite yet, but very, very soon. In reality, or if I may say, in the supernatural reality that is currently unfolding on this planet, Sophia herself is imminently engaged, not only in recalling that pact in intricate and specific detail, but also in enacting it. And in her divine being, in the dynamics of her divine life, which is the life of this planet, which is the life that sustains us and keeps us conscious. In that life process, she is at the point of realizing this intervention and performing it almost in the same instant. And the timing of this engagement, as I'll call it, the timing of her engagement now in the intervention she envisioned then is critical. It has reached critical state in the way that a nuclear meltdown reaches critical mass. And so the navigator follows with extreme attention the upcoming apogee surge of February 27th with the lunar apogee before the face of Cetus and Jupiter very, very close by. And in the coming month of March, which brings us to the first anniversary of correction on March 19th, and into the middle of April, the interaction between the lunar apogee in the ram and Jupiter in the ram provides the signal to see exactly when and how she now retrieves and achieves that intervention. This is a tremendous moment. This is a momentous event in correction, and it comes at an extremely dangerous time for the human species, as you all know. Now, those of you who are following this as crew members will find that this intel I'm giving you, this sacred intel from telestic sources, is critically time factored. Those of you in the crew in the Gaia navigation experiment are going to want to live with it moment by moment and day by day. That is our sublime opportunity. We are witnesses to the Nahual of the wisdom goddess, to her supernatural emergence. But even those who listen to this recording later on in time will be able to know what we did, will be able to put themselves in the place of those witnesses of correction in real time. And the value of knowing these things will be as great in the future as it is now. But the value of it now is imminent to a degree that I cannot even put in words. What I recount to you now is yet another page, another parchment page that we can separate from the clump that was stuck together. And this is, let us say, the fourth or fifth page of episode 4 On this page, we read the peculiar and absolutely extraordinary dilemma into which Sophia put herself without knowing what she was doing. Bear in mind that she's still in the Pleroma. She's still in the presence of the other Pleromic aeons in the galactic core. But bear in mind also, and realize if you can, empathically, that she was a young and prodigiously brilliant participant in the miracle of world making, that is the play of the aeons, in the dreams of worlds in the making and worlds dissolving, that is the play of the aeons. She was a prodigious and precocious participant. And in fact, it was the choice of the elder aeons and even her consort Thelete to leave her alone with this, to watch how she handled it by assuming entirely on her own to resolve the problem of the catastrophic destructive behavior of the Anthropos strain. She figured it out, but the way she figured it out got her into a most unusual situation. As Sophia considered the calibration of the Anthropos genome according to the seven elements that I've described, and as she realized that the primary problem was due to a superdose of her signature and the signature of Thelete, she determined to solve the problem by taking two measures that are available to aeons. One of these measures I've already described, that is, to make an intervention scenario. But what was she going to intervene in? How was she going to intervene? Before she could construct an intervention scenario in which she, as the co-engineer of the Anthropos template, would intervene in a world that went wrong, before she could even conceive an avataric descent, she had to set up the scenario in which that descent would occur. Now, I'll point out that she did determine, after her review of calibration and after she went through the hypothetical exercise of supposing how she would have intervened in those nine previous planetary settings, which are the nine avatars of Vishnu, upon all those reflections, she came to one very solid conclusion. She saw that the strength of the overdose of the two signatures was so excessive that it could be attributed as the reason for the experiments going wrong, obviously, but not just that. Recall that factor of our endowment called the paranoia, which is the ludic capacity to play and pretend. It was the combination of that capacity with the overdose, the double overdose of freedom and learning skills, that was the root of the problem, as Sophia understood it, as she realized by looking very, very deeply into those experiments. She realized that the overdose was so strong that it induced the disposition for the human species to turn away from its environment, Why would it do that? Well, it's really quite obvious. It certainly was obvious to her that the latitude of free will combined with a super learning capacity would give our species the predisposition to learn things that took us away from our conformity to our environment. In a certain respect, you could say, to sum up the problem, that we had too much freedom in our learning process, so that we could learn about a lot of things that weren't helpful to us in staying attuned to the very environment that allowed us to learn those things. And that wasn't even the worst of it. She saw that the superdose of signature capacities was so strong that it could lead us astray, and because of the paranoia, which is our capacity to play and pretend, we would not see what was going wrong. That combination showed her, and showed her very correctly, very precisely, why these anthropic experiments had turned out the way they did. Sadly, the beautiful species that she had designed was not able to flower and realize its true potential in a planetary setting and by extension in the cosmic pattern of things, precisely because of that syndrome. So, contemplating how it went wrong, how the 9 previous experiments had gone wrong, Sophia began in her own mind with her own enoia of intention and epinoia of imagination to construct a scenario in which that would not occur. And in order to do that, she had to take a measure which was known to happen among the Pleuromic Aeons. It was known to be a practice of the older aeons, which she herself had never performed, but she had seen it performed with other world experiments. She had not seen it performed with the 9 previous strains of the Anthropos, or perhaps she had. Interesting point to consider, interesting point to investigate as her recapitulation continues. But let's just say that this young, prodigious, and precocious aeon of a feminine gender had observed something that aeons can do, which can be called their second great option. The first great option being they can intervene avatarically. The second great option introduces an absolutely magnificent perspective into the Sophianic vision story, and also opens a portal of massive understanding for our situation in the cosmos and for our position in the third galactic arm of this galaxy. In the general course of things, aeons count on the arisal of planetary systems within the galactic arms by a process that is innate to the spiral arms. In other words, they seed the spiral arms with templates of sentient life. And then they allow the mechanism of the spiral arms itself to provide the planetary settings, because planets form and dissolve constantly in the spiral arms. And they love the factor of chance and of novelty, and they love to gamble on how these things will happen and how they will work out. The gods and the aeons are gamblers. And so when the filaments of a mycelium matrix of ascension species spread out through a galactic arm, they embed themselves upon planetary worlds that are arising here and there. And it's all kind of random. There's an element of chance in it. Naturally, the mycelian fibers spreading from a matrix like the Anthropos template will only seize upon those arising planetary worlds that provide somewhat hospitable conditions for them. Just like a plant, a climbing plant sending out its tendrils will do. And the aeons observe this with great delight, but they also reserve for themselves one magnificent and spectacular option. And that is the option to custom design a planetary system into which a sentient strain can find its niche. They can actually effectuate the conditions of a planetary system to customize it, as it were, for a particular experiment with a sentient organism. You see, there is enormous freedom in the cosmic process of emanation. And what the aeons know about freedom is the same thing that we know. To be free to do is to be free not to do. So they are free to leave these planetary experiments without a customization, or they are free to customize at will. Sophia knew this somehow or somewhere, and this is a part of her story to be investigated more deeply. She had observed the aeons doing this, and so she decided to do just that. In her passionate involvement with our humanity, she decided that she would not only customize a planetary system where the conditions would allow us to deal with our problem, but also, in the case that we failed to master our problem, even in the optimal conditions she provided, she would then intervene. She dreamed a double action, a double action. But the problem came with the customization process. How can the aeons in the Pleromic Center customize the conditions that arise in a planetary system that is emerging through the complex and spontaneous conditions of the churning of the spiral arms? Planetary formation happens in the spiral arms. We don't know how. We don't really know how. Science doesn't really know how. But it may well be that we can come to understand how by deep immersion in her story. Now, it so happened that in the recall of these events in the Pleroma, In January of 2012, the Aeon Sophia realized her mistake. The mistake that caused her to plummet or plunge from the galactic center. And it was indeed a kind of mistake, but even gods can make mistakes. And so the wisdom goddess did make a mistake in the perspective of the vast and spectacular actions of Pleuromic Aeons, because she was young and impetuous. And it was not only her impetuosity and her outrageous passion for our experiment that drew her from the galactic center, but it was also due, her plunge was also due to a technical mistake. When an Aeon chooses to customize a planetary setting so that it will receive a genomic strain of some kind, whether it be humanoid or otherwise, and provide optimal or carefully adapted conditions for that strain, rather than purely random conditions, it must do so according to an elaborate technical process. To describe this process, it might be helpful to use a rather strange analogy, and that is the experience of fly fishing. Now imagine that you're someone who likes to go fly fishing, which means that you go out to a river or a stream and you stand on the edge of the stream or maybe a little bit in it with your long fishing pole, which has a reel on it and a very, very fine line and a fly with a hook on the end of that line. So the fly is called that because it's sometimes a mimic of a fly, of a dragonfly, or some kind of insect that floats on the surface of the water. And the art of fly fishing consists of casting your line out upon the stream that's flowing in front of you and dropping the fly into a certain place in the river where it floats, and then a fish perhaps mistakes it for an insect, bites, and you reel it in. Now, as you consider this analogy, feel how the fishing pole feels in your hand. It has a handle, and just above the handle is the reel with the cord. The cord goes up the long, supple fishing pole through a series of loops to the end. The cord feeds off the end. When you cast it, it makes a high arc, and you drop the fly into the streaming river. As you picture that analogy, feel the tension of the line. As soon as the fly drops into the water, there is tension on the line. When you cast, there is no tension. The line makes a whirring sound. It makes a high arc over the river. And then the fly drops into the water. But as soon as it does, it is seized by the flow of the water. The tension of the water streaming downstream pulls on the fly. So you have the streaming of the river pulling on the fly. It pulls on the entire line up to the tip of your rod, down along the length of your rod, and it pulls on the reel. So there is a complete continuity of tension between the reel and the fly that is pulled by the streaming of the water where it has been cast. Now, that tension is like the attention of the Pleuromic Aeons when they give themselves to the activity to customize a world in the spiral arms. Remember the formula in Planetary Tantra that we use in courting. Tension and attention are the same. But there is a technical trick involved in the customization of a world. Because if the aeons released the tension of their attention, of their dreaming attention, if they merely released it and threw it out or cast it into the spiral arms like a fisherman casting a lure, they would not be able to customize the planetary world that was the object of their attention. Because their attention would be drawn into the general flow of the spiral arms, and it would simply dissolve into the elementary processes that happen in the spiral arms. And so they have to have recourse to a particular mechanism in order for them to achieve the customization of a planetary habitat that would suit an experiment they have set in motion. And they do this using a device called an astral stem. How would you imagine what is an astral stem? Well, return to the analogy of fly fishing. Suppose that you're standing there at the bank of a beautiful river that's curving around in front of you, the same way that the aeons stand at the boundary of the pleuromic center and watch the beautiful rivers of the spiral arms circling around them. But imagine that as you look out to this river, this shallow river flowing from right to left in front of you, there is a pole standing upright in the riverbed. How it got there? Well, we don't exactly know. Suppose that somewhere upstream, a tree fell into the river, a dead tree, or maybe a living tree. But somehow the limbs of that tree were torn off as it flowed down the river, and all that was left was the stem, like a pole. And suppose that at some point the pole carried by the current of the river fetched up in some rocks somehow, and in a very curious manner ended up standing vertically out there in the middle of the riverbed. So there you are, a fly fisherman, and you're looking at this vertical pole which is standing there in front of you, maybe 20 or 30 feet away. Now suppose that you become a very extraordinary kind of fly fisherman, because you perform a trick, a technical feat of fly fishing that is really, really remarkable. When you cast your line out to the streaming river with its lure on the end that is intended to fall into the stream, you cast it not overhead in an arc that goes up and down, but you cast it in a sideways loop. And in doing so, you cause the line of your fishing pole to fetch up on the vertical pole that is standing in the riverbed and wind around it. What a fantastic art that would be. What a fantastic feat that would be. And you would be quite an artist of fly fishing if you had such control of your line that you could cast it out and make it whirl several times around this pole. And then the end of it with the fly on it would drop into the river. Well, what a different situation that would be. Because the fly or the lure, which in this case corresponds to the planetary setting the aeons intend to customize, would actually not float away on the currents of the galactic stream. It would still float on the galactic stream, but it would hold in one place. And by holding in that one place, because the line has been wound around the pole, that would allow special conditions to develop in the place where the lure has landed. This analogy explains the complex process in which aeons employ an astral stem in the galactic arms in order to achieve what is called the play of a spooling narrative. A spooling narrative is the metaphor for the story that an aeon constructs for the planetary setting that they want to customize. It's all done by a story, just like the genome of the Anthropos is really a story. It's a story about a creature endowed with certain capacities. But the story is not written all the way to the end, because the creature has the ability to write its own story and to participate in how its story unfolds. When the aeons decide to customize a planetary system for a particular creature to evolve, they do it through another narrative function of the pleromic powers, which is called the play of spooling narratives. And so, the aeons must observe this cosmic process themselves. They cannot merely spin out their anoia into some place in the galactic arms and fetch on to a world that is evolving, a planet that is evolving, and customize it. They have to use the astral stem to stabilize the process so that they can actually seize upon the elementary physics that occur in the spiral arms and locate their dreaming in a particular place on a particular planet. And they have to hold that planet steady, just as the lure would be held steady if the line were wrapped around the vertical pole when the fisherman casts it. This is a very, very high art of pleromic dreaming, the art that allows them to achieve the play of spooling narratives. And so the astral stem, which they use for this process, must already be present structurally somewhere in the galactic arm. It must be a formation, a stem, or more properly speaking, a spindle that has formed in the galactic arm, rather in the way that a reef forms in the ocean. And around this astral stem or spindle, they can wrap these spooling narratives. And only in that way can they achieve the customization of a planetary setting for a particular creature that has been designed in the galactic core. So, to bring this elaborate story to its conclusion, and to the final pages that have been missing in episode 4, we picture exactly what the situation was that faced the aeons of fire. And we realize how she intended to do something that could only be done by a technical process that she had not mastered. She had seen it done, but she had never done it herself. And she didn't know how to do it, really. She wanted to customize a world where we could emerge in such a way that our interaction with the world would teach us to overcome our destructive tendencies. And the specific conditions that she set for that world, the preparation of the environment that we would require, are also part of her January recall. Those specific conditions and accompanying them, the conditions of her intervention pact, are the subject of my next episode in tracking her recapitulation. But for now, to conclude this remarkable chapter, let me point out something coming ahead, something to be anticipated in the Gaia navigation experiment. Understand that for an aeon in the Pleromic Center to customize a planetary environment to achieve the play of spooling narrative, according to this fly fishing analogy that I'm proposing, understand that the aeon needs to use an astral stem that is already present in the structure of the galactic arm. This is actually the case with the third galactic arm that we inhabit. There is, in fact, such an astral stem or spindle structurally present in our region of the third spiral arm, and that is called the Pleiades. The Pleiades is the spindle used to generate spooling narratives to customize planetary systems. And it is the astral stem the Aeon Shafaya ought to have used. But she didn't. Because even though she understood that such a stem was required technically to perform what she wanted to do, namely to customize an environment, she did not know how to engage one. She did not know how to cast her lure in that direction. So when she cast out her lure without being able to wrap it around the astral stem of the Pleiades, the tension of the line on her lure pulled her out of the galactic center. Now it so happens that in September of 2012, the apogee of the moon reaches the Pleiades. And I will leave it to you, to your imagination, and to your empathy, to consider and to anticipate what that event means and how it will play into her correction and into our participation in that correction. So I'll leave it in that place for now and look forward to speaking to you again with the unread pages of episode 5 of the Sophianic Vision story.